Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. This week we're going to do something a little special. We're going to do a Just for the Health of It greatest hits and going to take some best of in the past. Let's see what we can queue up. Let's start with a wonderful little riff on the pillars of health and epidemiology, the science of public health. Adhering to just four simple healthy lifestyle factors can have a strong impact on the prevention of chronic diseases. Not smoking, not being obese, getting a half hour of exercise a day, and eating healthier. And eating healthier is defined as consuming more fruits, veggies, and whole grains, and less meat. These four factors alone account for 78% of chronic disease risk. This is good news for all of us who want more control over our health. This is also a useful example of epidemiology, the science that distinguishes public health from all other disciplines. Epidemiology is the study and analysis of the distribution and determinants of health and disease conditions in defined populations. And today I'd like to riff on some epidemiology. And where else but WAKT, We Act Radio 106.1 FM Toledo, where will you hear riffs on epidemiology? Of these four simple healthy lifestyle factors, not smoking, not being obese, getting a half hour of exercise a day, and eating healthier, I focused last week on diet. And most people have some awareness of the importance of diet and exercise in healthy living. One thing common between diet and exercise is their role in maintaining a healthy body weight. Both a healthy diet and exercise are dose dependent, meaning that they offer progressive benefits with progressive improvements in diet and more exercise. But how about the relative importance of diet versus exercise in health? It turns out that diet is even more important than exercise. Perhaps the easiest way to illustrate this is a study of heart health, where the heart health of sedentary vegans was compared to marathon runners eating typical American diets. The sedentary vegans, with little physical activity, but eating an exclusively plant-based diet, had better heart health than marathon runners eating a mixed diet with animal-based foods such as meat, eggs, cheese, and butter. Fortunately, the benefits of a healthy diet and generous amounts of exercise are additive, so please do both. But let's return to the remaining healthy lifestyle factors that we didn't talk about last show. That is not smoking. Not smoking is part of a pillar of health of avoiding toxins, which would also include avoiding the abusive use of alcohol and drugs. Tobacco use is the leading preventable cause of death in the United States, tripling your death rate, causing almost 500,000 premature deaths each year, with about 40,000 of those deaths due to secondhand smoke. Excessive alcohol use causes about 88,000 premature deaths a year. Over 100,000 Americans are killed by drug overdoses each year, the majority from opioids. Still, five times as many Americans are killed each year from legal drug use than illegal drug use. That is, from tobacco and alcohol use than illegal drugs like opioids, and cocaine. Of course, not all deaths are the same. Some deaths happen at a much earlier age. Someone dying at 85 is very different than someone dying at 25. In public health, we use something called years of potential life lost, which helps take into account the amount of premature death, say by counting the years lost before age 75 in a death. Using this method, we get a different perspective on premature death. For instance, when considering premature death, cancer overtakes heart disease as the number one killer in America. Also, deaths from injuries jump up in the rankings of premature killers. This is true for both intentional injuries, that is, homicide and suicide, and from unintentional injuries, such as from motor vehicles, falls, poisonings, and drownings. Please note that public health folks don't use the term accidents. We prefer the term injuries because injuries have causes that can be ascertained and possibly prevented. They aren't simply accidents. If you like, you can include protection from violent injury, a social toxin, under the pillar of health of avoiding toxins. Now, back to not all deaths being the same. Even considering the tragedy of premature death, some deaths are much more traumatic, both physically and socially. For instance, violence and drug overdoses add a whole different layer of trauma to a community's health. Further, different forms of death may have very different social meanings. For example, homicide gets far more attention than suicide, yet suicide is more common than murder. While suicide is tragic and baffling, the larger community tends to view it as less threatening than murder. This may be in part because murder strikes at most people's sense of personal safety more than does suicide. Statistically, you are more of a threat to kill yourself than to be killed by anyone else. We greatly underestimate the risk of suicide compared to other risks of fatal injury. For example, even in high-risk occupations, suicide is a greater threat than direct occupational risks. Firemen and women are more likely to kill themselves than be killed in a fire. Policemen and policewomen are more likely to kill themselves than be killed by a criminal. Those in the military are more likely to kill themselves than be killed in combat. High-risk occupations do have higher rates of suicide due to higher levels of stress and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Still, doctors and dentists have higher suicide rates than police officers. There's more one way that an occupation can kill you. Discussions of health typically focus on physical health problems. Unfortunately, mental health issues get neither equal nor adequate attention. For instance, depression is the most common and disabling threat that Americans experience. Depression robs us of untold measures of quality of life. Up until now, in this riff of epidemiology, I have focused mostly on mortality, which, while a very hard endpoint, can somewhat miss the point of a quality of life. For every mortality, there is much morbidity, that is, disease and suffering. Disability casts a long shadow. For example, for every gun death, there are 6 people shot and injured, often with long-term physical and mental damage. Further, health is more than the mere absence of disease, disability, and suffering. So I want to touch on another area that serves as a pillar of health. That area is rest and resiliency. Sleep is the most obvious example that we all share of restorative health. The CDC considers lack of sleep a public health epidemic. Sleep deprivation can lead to a number of serious health problems, including obesity, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, depression, and even heart attack and stroke. Because sleep deprivation shortens our attention span and reduces alertness, can also lead to car crashes, industrial accidents, and other occupational hazards. Almost 1 in 3 American adults say that they are sleeping less than 6 hours each night. Most adults should be getting between 7 and 9 hours of sleep each night. Lack of sleep undercuts our body and mind's ability to maintain health. Within the pillar of health that is rest and resiliency is social support and purpose. This includes loving and supportive relationships and things like personal passion and positive attitude. By the way, you did hear that right. Love is a public health issue. Even one loving relationship can serve as a powerful buffer against the stresses of life. Developing passions and positive attitudes can also serve us well to propel us through life's difficulties. I will try to speak of such things more on this show. Better yet, I'll try to model such things. Let me review those pillars of health. A healthy diet with more fruits, veggies, and whole grains and less meat. Maintaining a healthy body weight. Physical activity. Avoiding toxins like smoking and abusive use of alcohol and drugs. Maintaining environment free of violence and injuries. Getting adequate sleep. Maintaining loving and supportive relationships. And developing personal passions and a positive attitude. Well, that riff harkened back to April 2019, as does this one. Greetings, lovers of Mother Earth. Today I'd like to jump right in with a big question. Can you be a serious environmentalist without cutting down drastically on animal foods? That is, cutting way down on meat, eggs, and dairy. I'll cut right to the chase and say that a sustainable future on this planet requires a drastic reduction in livestock and dairy production. If you consider yourself an environmentalist and you haven't already cut way down on meat, eggs, and dairy, are you willing to do your share? This question is just the kind of question I like to address here at Just for the Health of It. This question gets at the heart of the intersection of social justice and personal human health, not to mention humane treatment of billions of animals. Whatever personal difficulty you may face in cutting way down on meat, eggs, and dairy, you should take some comfort in that eating a plant-based diet can offer you profound improvements in your health. So let's dig into the environmental impact of animal-based foods. First category, food security. Globally, one-third of crops are fed to animals. That's about two-thirds in the U.S. Feeding crops to animals to produce food results in a 75% loss in caloric value and over an 80% loss of protein. In the category of water pollution, livestock produce 7 to 9 times more manure output than humans do. And as it happens, fecal matter makes it into the water supply. In fact, most food poisonings, even if from plant sources, are traceable back to livestock. Often these concentrated animal feeding operations, factories. Livestock production accounts for 60% of nitrogen pollution released into the environment. And nitrogen, along with phosphorus, are what we see that bring about the huge algae blooms that we have here in the Toledo area. In the category of land competition, some livestock rearing can be considered resource efficient by using land unsuitable for crops or forests, or by consuming crop residues, but only about 30% of current production levels could be reared in this way. And livestock are linked to about 70% of historic deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. Regarding climate change, studies show that to stop global temperatures rising beyond the dangerous 2 degrees Celsius level of climate change, demand for livestock products must be reduced. 1/7 of global greenhouse gas emissions are due to livestock production. And regarding biodiversity loss, livestock production is a major driver of biodiversity loss globally, accounting for about 30% of human-caused losses. What does the future look like? If the entire world were to eat the average North American diet, this would result in a 320% increase in the global consumption of animal protein and require a doubling in the area of global cropland. So why does all this matter? Livestock are the single largest human-caused source of non-CO2 greenhouse gases, producing 44% of methane and 53% of nitrous oxide emissions. Non-CO2 gas reductions are essential to achieving global climate targets. And depending on the accounting method used, livestock produces somewhere between 50 and 80% of global agricultural emissions. If current trends towards increasing consumption of livestock continue, and if a cap on emissions is put in place to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius or less by 2050, 70% of the cap would be taken up by the livestock sector alone. Studies show that in order to achieve greenhouse gas reductions from the livestock sector, consistent with keeping climate change below the dangerous 2 degrees Celsius level, reduction in demand of animal foods will be essential. So how big of an opportunity does this present? Modeling suggests that worldwide adoption of the Harvard Healthy Diet, which does include a modest amount of meat, could reduce the cost of cutting emissions in the energy sector by up to 50%, and that under a global plant-based scenario, savings could be as great as 80%. A recent review of mitigation opportunities in agriculture up to 2030 compared the Harvard Healthy Diet scenario to actions in other sectors and found it to have a higher potential than any other option. Another personal bonus for eating a plant-based diet is that toxins like pesticides and heavy metals get concentrated as you go up the food chain. So eating lower on the food chain greatly reduces your dietary exposures to toxins. For myself, living simply is something that I value, and living simply dovetails well with stewardship of the earth and opting out of the rampant consumerism endemic in Western culture. I also see living simply as a way to increase our personal freedom as well as our collective freedom. And as yet another bonus in today's show, on this theme of living simply, I am going to debut another feature of Just for the Health of It, that is poetry. Since poetry is one of my passions and another of my unpaid gigs, I will share poetry with you on occasion. Today's poem is entitled A Taste for Happiness. Dining with kings and queens, courtly balls, knightly duels, and priestly indulgences, you can avoid it all if only you are happy eating beans. Thank you, thank you. You can clap or snap your fingers if you like. Better yet, eat more beans for your own benefit, the benefit of our planet, and as one way to carve out a little more personal economic freedom and a healthier body politic. As a matter of credit, I'd like to note that this poem is inspired by a traditional Sufi story of Nasruddin, who is eating a poor man's diet of chickpeas and bread. His neighbor, who claimed to be a wise man, was living in a grand house and dining on sumptuous meals provided by the emperor himself. His neighbor told Nasruddin, "If only you would learn to flatter the emperor and be subservient like I do, you would not have to live on chickpeas and bread." Nasruddin replied, "And if only you would learn to live on chickpeas and bread like I do, you would not have to flatter and live subservient to the emperor." In my humble opinion, anything that loosens our subservience to the empire or emperor is healthy for each of us and all of us. And next up, another flashback from April 2019. As true today as it was then, this one, don't be confused by the misinformation from industry regarding salt. Salt consumption is a major risk factor for poor health. Here we go. I want to start off with some good news. Drum roll, please. After a century, a voice for the U.S. salt industry goes quiet. The Salt Institute has existed for just over a century, and now it has dissolved. The Salt Institute, the voice of the U.S. salt industry, spent decades questioning government efforts to limit American salt consumption. Michael Jacobson, co-founder of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, which bills itself as America's food watchdog, says, "The Salt Institute, as long as I followed it for maybe 30 years, has done nothing but muddy the waters about salt and health. My feeling is, good riddance to this organization." And from nutritionfacts.org, in a related story, continuing with the whole salt deal, don't be confused by big salt. High blood pressure is not the only harmful effect of too much salt. It also has been tied to stomach cancer, kidney stones, bone loss, obesity, and direct damage to our kidneys, arteries, and heart. But when billions of dollars are at stake, the case is never closed. One can just follow the press releases of the Salt Institute. What about the recent study published in the American Journal of Hypertension that found the amount of salt we are eating is just fine, suggesting a kind of U-shaped curve where too much sodium is bad, but too little could be bad too? These studies have been widely misinterpreted, stirring unnecessary controversy and confusion. It basically comes down to three issues: measurement error, confounding, and reverse causality. All this data comes from studies that were not designed to assess this relationship, and they tended to use invalid sodium estimates simply because it's hard to do the multiple 24-hour urine collections that are necessary to get a good measurement. And in the United States, many of those eating less salt are simply eating less food, maybe because they're so sick, so it's no wonder they'd have higher mortality rates. So compiling these studies together is viewed as kind of like garbage in, garbage out. But why would they do that? They claim to have no conflicts of interest. When confronted with evidence showing at least one of the co-authors received thousands of dollars from the Salt Institute, they replied they didn't get more than $5,000 from them in the last 12 months, so no conflict of interest. If instead you look at the trials in which they did the gold standard 24-hour urine collections in healthy people to avoid the reverse causation and controlled for confounders, the curve instead has a continuous decrease of cardiovascular disease events like heart attacks and strokes as sodium levels get lower and lower. There was a 17% increase of cardiovascular disease for every gram of sodium reduced per day. You might note that Americans usually eat between 3 and 6 grams of salt a day. And this is all for people without high blood pressure. We'd expect the benefit to be even greater for the 78 million Americans with hypertension. Unfortunately, the media has widely misreported the findings, and a false sense of controversy has been broadcast, confusing the public. But it's not just the media. When editorials are published on the subject in some of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, you don't expect them to be written by someone who got paid personal fees by Big Salt. Before she accepted money from the Salt Institute, the author was accepting money from the Tobacco Institute and was a frequent expert witness in defense of Philip Morris and other tobacco companies. So if that's who the New England Journal of Medicine chooses to editorialize about salt, you can see the extent of industry influence. The editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Hypertension himself worked for many years as a consultant to the Salt Institute. Well, from an evolutionary perspective, salt is unnatural. For 99% of human evolution, salt was scarce in the human diet. We evolved to have highly efficient sodium-preserving bodies. We can survive perfectly well on 200 milligrams of sodium a day. The typical American consumes 20-plus times that amount each day. Is it any surprise that for older Americans, it is actually unusual to not have high blood pressure? And this is a global problem. In modern times, salt is widely available, a cheap and easy way to spice up foods, and we pay the price for it. 1 in 3 people in the world have high blood pressure. It is important to note that for heart disease and stroke, the lower your blood pressure, the better. Your risk for heart attacks and stroke drops continuously down to a blood pressure of about 100 over 60, which happens to be the normal lifelong blood pressure of indigenous peoples eating traditional diets with no added salt. So the bottom line is this: the less salt, the better, even if you do not have a diagnosis of high blood pressure. Enough of salt, though. I'd like to use salt as a segue to our next segment, the three most dangerous food additives. So, what are the three most dangerous food additives? If you guess salt is one of them, then you have been paying attention. So what are the other two most dangerous food additives? Drum roll, please. Added sugars and added fats. Together, added salt, sugars, and fats are the cheap and unhealthy foundation of the modern processed foods industry. Added fats and sugars make up about 40% of the calories in the American food supply, packing lots of calories while offering very few nutrients. Added fats and sugars crowd out nutritious whole foods and profoundly dilute the health-giving powers of whole foods that are present in the diet. The ultra-refined and overprocessed American diet is capped off with refined grains, which when considered with added sugars and fats comprise most of our diet. Only about 12% of grains eaten in the United States are whole grains. The U.S. recommendation for whole grains is that at least half of grains eaten be whole grains. Almost nobody meets that recommendation. As a side note, the brouhaha over whether carbohydrates are good or bad is really more about whether a carbohydrate is in whole food form or refined. There's no need to worry about eating sugar in the form of whole fruit. There is no need to worry about consuming carbohydrates in the form of whole grains. The divide between disease-producing and health-promoting is basically the divide between eating foods in whole food form or in an overprocessed, so-called refined form. Now, back to the three most dangerous food additives. There are thousands of different food additives, and it can be dizzying to try to even begin to sort through them. However, this is a case of counting your dollars before your pennies. Cutting down on salt and added sugars and fats is more important than all of the other food additives combined. So feel free to worry about the dizzying array of weird-sounding ingredients on nutrition labels, but make sure that you have first gotten a handle on limiting salt, added sugars, and fats. Better yet, try eating lots of foods that don't even have nutrition labels, such as fresh fruits and vegetables. Okay, and next from the archives was a follow-up to that story with ways to cut down on salt and sugar and to get more whole grains in your diet, which happened to be salt, added sugar, and added fats. I wanted to revisit that because I inadvertently skipped an article about healthier salt substitutes and wanted to spend a little bit more time going back and talking about what are things you can actually do to reduce these most dangerous food additives in our diet. So, from nutritionfacts.org, the two most prominent dietary risks for death and disability in the world are not eating enough fruit and eating too much salt. Eating too little fruit kills nearly 5 million people every year, and eating too much salt kills 4 million. And as a little aside, a nutrition bonus, this has to do with sister nutrients, sodium and potassium. Fruits are very good sources of potassium worldwide, and we find that high blood pressure and the effects of salt are very much aggravated if you also have low potassium intakes. So it's good to get lots of potassium and little sodium. The more the better for potassium. Eat your fruits and vegetables. Okay, back to the healthier salt substitutes. There are three things we can do to lower our salt intake. First, don't add salt to the table. One third of us add salt to our food before even tasting it. Second, stop adding salt while you're cooking. At first, the food may taste bland, but within 2 to 4 weeks, as the sensitivity of the salt taste receptors in the mouth become more sensitive to the taste of salt in the usual concentrations, believe it or not, you may actually prefer the taste of food with less salt. Some of the flavorings you can use in the meanwhile, instead of salt, include pepper, onion, garlic, tomato, lime, chili, curry, and lemon. Even if you did add salt while cooking, though, it's probably better than eating out, where even at non-fast food restaurants, they tend to pile it on. And finally, avoid processed foods that have salt added. In most countries, only about half of sodium intake comes from processed food, so there's more personal responsibility and control. In the United States, however, even if we completely stopped adding salt in the kitchen and dining room, it would only bring down salt intake a small fraction. This has led public health commentators to note how challenging it is for everyone to reduce their salt intake. So much of our sodium intake is out of our control. But is it? We don't have to buy all those processed foods. We can choose not to turn over our family's health to food corporations that may not have our best interests at heart. Okay, well, that's swimming upstream, but something very worthy to do. Okay, now back, you remember the three most dangerous food additives, salt, added sugar, and added fats. And then this moved on to the great diluters in our diet, which were added sugars and fats, but also refined grains, which together, added fats, added sugars, and refined grains are over half of our diet in America. So I wanted to cover a few things about how we can get some more whole grains into our diet. So this is from choosemyplate.gov. Tips: make half of your grains whole grains. Substitute a whole grain product for a refined product, such as eating whole wheat bread instead of white bread or brown rice instead of white rice. Use whole grains in mixed dishes. It's a particularly good tip, since if you're new to the taste of a lot of whole grains, you can kind of mix it in with a bunch of stuff and it won't be quite as noticeable. One whole grain that's often overlooked is a whole corn. You can get whole corn flour or masa. Most corn tortillas are whole grain. Oatmeal is one of those grains that we normally eat whole grain. In fact, you can't really eat it otherwise. It's impossible to refine, in essence. And one little tip there for you meat eaters, you can add 3/4 cup of oatmeal to ground beef or turkey when making meatballs, burgers, or meatloaf. And when you're snacking, you can snack on ready-to-eat whole grain cereals such as toasted oat cereal. How about trying 100% whole grain snack crackers? Even popcorn. A whole grain can be a healthy snack if made with little or no added salt or butter. Just use oil instead of butter. I like to sprinkle it with Parmesan cheese and or nutritional yeast and maybe even a little red pepper to spice it up. So one of the easiest things probably to switch out is bread. There's a lot of different breads to choose from, and if you like kind of the soft, mushy bread, you can find whole wheat bread that fits that category. But one thing you have to look for is on the labels. With bread labels particularly, foods labeled with the words multigrain, stone ground, 100% wheat, cracked wheat, 7-grain, or bran are usually not even whole grain products. Also, color is not an indication of a whole grain. Bread can be brown because of molasses or other coloring ingredients. Read the ingredients to list to see if it is whole grain. Make sure whole grain is the first ingredient. Ingredients, by the way, are listed by weight. Okay, how about cutting down on sugar? The biggest thing you can do is cut out sugary beverages. That comes in a lot of forms. Soda is the most common, but there's a lot of juice drinks out there that really have very little juice and mostly just sugar water. Another popular one is fancy coffees. You add all kinds of things to that, and instead of just getting coffee, you're getting a lot of sugar and added fats. Second thing next to sugary beverages is the desserts, pastries, and candy, one most people are familiar with. Just cut down that a bit. And third, lots of hidden sugars in processed foods. This is where you have to read labels. The new labeling law is coming into effect, and you'll notice on some labels that it will actually list added sugars. And what that does is tells you how many are added sugars with refined ingredients, not just natural sugars found, for instance, like in fruit. And also there's lots of names of sugar, so beware. And actually, organic sugar is really no better than regular sugar. And switching gears a bit, this from May of 2019 from Mental Health Month. May is Mental Health Month, and I'd like to begin this show with some basic mental health facts. Almost 44 million adults experience mental illness in any given year. 1 in 5 adults in America experience a mental illness. Nearly 1 in 25, or about 10 million adults in America, live with a serious mental illness. 1/2 of all chronic mental illness begins by the age of 14, 3/4 by the age of 24. 1 in 100, or about 2.4 million American adults, live with schizophrenia. 2.6%, or 6.1 million of American adults, live with bipolar disease. 6.9%, or about 16 million American adults, live with major depression. And 18.1%, or 42 million American adults, live with one of a variety of anxiety disorders. 10.2 million adults have co-occurring mental health and addiction disorders. 26% of those that are homeless and are staying in shelters live with serious mental illness. Approximately 24% of state prisoners have a recent history of a mental health condition. Depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide and is a major contributor to the global burden of disease. In the U.S., serious mental illness costs $193 billion in lost earnings every year. 90% of those who die by suicide have an underlying mental illness. suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. Nearly 60% of adults with a mental illness didn't receive mental health services in the previous year. African American and Hispanic Americans used mental health services at about one-half the rate of whites, and Asian Americans at about one-third the rate. While tens of millions of Americans have to deal with diagnosable mental illnesses, everyone can benefit from building mental wellness and mental and emotional resiliency. From mentalhealthamerica.net, I want to talk about one of those aspects, which is social connections and recreation. Loneliness is bad for your health. Poor social supports make it harder to recover from mental illnesses, while a strong social support system improves overall outcomes and the ability to bounce back from stress. Strong interaction and recreation are all around good for you. People with strong social relationships are 50% more likely to live longer. People who do things in nature have better perceptions of their own emotional well-being. Adolescents who participate in sports have lower odds of suffering from depression or thinking about suicide, likely because sports increase self-esteem and social support. And considerations for caregivers, feelings of loneliness and isolation are common among caregivers. Adult daycare and other respite programs can help reduce the demands on caregivers, which may improve morale and allow more time for social and recreational activities. Moving to work-life balance, work allows you to provide for yourself and your family while also serving a purpose in the community. But when it takes over your life, it can negatively affect your health. Work-life balance is important. Of adults employed full-time in the U.S., nearly 40% report working at least 50 hours per week, and 18% report working 60 hours or more each week. People who feel they have a good work-life balance are more satisfied with their job and their life and experience fewer symptoms of depression and anxiety. More than half of people who responded to Mental Health America's Work Health Survey say that they do unhealthy things such as drinking, drug use, or lashing out at others to cope with workplace stress. Over 75% of people are afraid of getting punished for taking a day off to attend to their mental health. More than two-thirds of people have had their sleep negatively affected by workplace issues. Poor work-life balance increases your risk for health conditions like sleep problems, digestive disorders, and mental health problems. This is especially true for people who work longer shifts or on nights and weekends. Working overtime increases the likelihood of having symptoms of depression, especially among men. And lastly, I want to cover a little topic from Mental Health America, humor. Finding humor in the circumstances of life can lift moods with laughter and help people to better deal with and overcome difficult experiences. What happens to our bodies when we laugh? Levels of stress hormones decrease. Your heart, lungs, and muscles are stimulated. There is increased activity in parts of the brain's reward system. And endorphins, the body's natural pain blockers, are released. Incorporating humor into your daily life has many potential benefits: a stronger immune system, improved mood and anxiety relief, better interactions with others, and less burnout on the job. Stress and the hormones it produces can do a lot of damage to the mind and body over time. Since humor and laughter reduce the amounts of these hormones, it has also been shown that they can help reduce the risk of blood clots, heart conditions, and other stress-related diseases. And in a related story from June of 2019, the importance of happiness and purpose in driving health and well-being, and the epidemic of meaninglessness in work life. I want to start off today's episode going big, looking at how happiness and meaning can drive good health. This from The Nation's Health, which is a publication of the American Public Health Association. Happiness can be good for your health. Happiness is more than just a state of mind. It can also be a path to better overall health and well-being. Happiness can be described as feelings of joy and pleasure, or it can mean having a sense of purpose, or maybe it's as simple as having a high sense of satisfaction with your life. Since a large amount of disease is now lifestyle-induced rather than infectious, it would seem that psychosocial well-being is a crucial thing, especially in light of the fact that happy people are typically better at practicing healthy behaviors. So, what makes people happy? It may not be what you think. First up, money. Having money, especially a lot of it, is associated with better health and a longer life. The science is clear on that. However, it's less clear on how much a role money plays in creating happiness. A 2018 study that looked at 1.7 million people around the world found that happiness is associated with a lot less money than what you might think. In general, it found that people making between $60,000 and $75,000 a year are likely to be happy on a day-to-day basis. As income grew beyond levels associated with happiness, life satisfaction actually began to go down. Another myth is that happiness is associated with youth. But again, research has debunked that idea. People get happier as they age. In fact, those over 50 are generally happier than they were during younger years. At the University of California, Berkeley, researchers at the Greater Good Science Center have collected research-based ways to help create happiness. They include walking and enjoying nature, to meditation and expressive writing. Among the tips for inspiring more happiness in your life, take an intentional time out each week for 15 minutes to focus on a positive event in your life and what allowed it to happen. Perform a weekly act of kindness, which can create a greater sense of personal well-being and happiness. Write a letter of gratitude to someone you never thanked and take time to personally deliver it to them. When you're out among people you don't know, strike up a conversation. Find out what interests them and get to know the person. Write down three things that went well for you each day for a week and explain why. Take a walk and notice the positive things around you. Science shows a walk of just 20 minutes can lift your mood. Give up something you love for a period of time, then re-experience the pleasure of it when you begin it again. Pay attention to nature that is around you every day and how it makes you feel. We are not just talking here about the absence of stress, but the presence of enjoyment of life, optimism, and life satisfaction. Well, I'd like to go a lot deeper here because happiness is more than just those positive experiences. It's integrally linked to purpose. And I want to talk. So here's an article from NPR. What's your purpose? Finding a sense of meaning in life is linked to health. Having a purpose in life, whether building guitars or swimming or volunteer work, affects your health, researchers found. It even appeared to be more important for decreasing risk of death than exercising regularly. People who didn't have a strong life purpose, which was defined as, quote, a self-organizing life aim that stimulates goals, end of quote, were more likely to die than those who did, and specifically more likely to die of cardiovascular diseases. Hey folks, you gotta take care of your heart, and it will take care of you. Continuing. People without a strong life purpose were more than twice as likely to die. This association between a low level of purpose in life and death remained true despite how rich or poor participants were, and regardless of gender, race, or education level. The researchers also found the association to be so powerful that having a life purpose appeared to be more important for decreasing risk of death than drinking, smoking, or exercising regularly. Just like people have basic physical needs, like to sleep and eat and drink, they have basic psychological needs, says Alan Rozansky, a professor at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, who was not involved in this research but has studied the relationship between life purpose and physical health. The need for meaning and purpose is number one, Rozansky adds. It's the deepest driver of well-being there is. Woohoo! Well, and being the science freak that I am, I actually dug into the original article that they're reporting on here. This from JAMA Network. Association between life purpose and mortality among U.S. adults older than 50 years. And the thing I found most interesting is it says, our study included a comprehensive analysis of psychological well-being constructs, including four negative psychological measures, depression, anxiety, cynical hostility, and negative affect, and three positive psychological measures: optimism, positive affect, and social participation. It is possible that some or all of these psychological well-being constructs are mediators. So, what did they do? They created two models that adjusted for these seven psychological measures. And what did they find? That the strong relationship between life purpose and mortality still persisted. I think this is important because this leads to an understanding of how deep purpose is and how it's connected to our well-being and our health. Even when you look at things like depression or anxiety or cynical hostility or negative affect or optimism or positive affect or social participation, if you control for all of those things, purpose still has a very powerful, independent effect on our health. This is the going big part of it. It's very easy, like I read off that list about happiness, the things you can do to improve your happiness, and those are all well and fine. But the thing is, without purpose, we're delinking ourselves from basically our life source and something so basic to life that health and well-being cannot flourish or thrive. Okay. And I want to link this to something else that I've been thinking about for a long time, at least these last few years. And this is an article from WeForum. It's a growing number of people think their job is useless. Time to rethink the meaning of work. In a 2013 survey of 12,000 professionals by the Harvard Business Review, half said they felt their job had, quote, no meaning and significance. And an equal number were unable to relate to their company's mission. While another poll among 230,000 employees in 142 different countries showed that only 13% of workers actually like their job. A more recent poll among Brits revealed that as many as 37% think they have a job that is utterly useless. They have what anthropologist David Graeber refers to as BS jobs. On paper, these jobs sound fantastic, and yet there are scores of successful professionals with imposing LinkedIn profiles and impressive salaries who nevertheless go home every evening grumbling that their work serves no purpose. Let's get one thing clear, though. I'm not talking about the sanitation workers, the teachers, and nurses of the world. If these people were to go on strike, we'd have an instant state of emergency on our hands. No, I'm talking about the growing army of consultants, bankers, tax advisors, managers, and others who earn their money in strategic trans-sector peer-to-peer meetings to brainstorm the value add of co-creation in the network society, or something to that effect. It starts with an age-old question. What is the meaning of life? Most people would say the meaning of life is to make the world a little more beautiful, or nicer, or more interesting. But how? These days, our main answer to that is through work. Our definition of work, however, is incredibly narrow. Only the work that generates money is allowed to count towards GDP. Little wonder, then, that we have organized education around feeding as many people as possible in bite-sized, flexible parcels into the employment establishment. Yet what happens when a growing proportion of people deemed successful by the measure of our knowledge economy say that their work is pointless? That's one of the biggest taboos of our times. Our whole system is finding meaning. Our whole system of finding meaning could dissolve like a puff of smoke. Like Brad Pitt says in Fight Club too often, we're working jobs we hate so we can buy stuff we don't need. And he didn't say stuff, he said another S word. Again, working jobs we hate so we can buy S we don't need. The time has come to stop sidestepping the debate and home in on the real issue. What would our work look like if we were to radically redefine the meaning of work? I firmly believe that a universal basic income is the most effective answer to the dilemma of advancing robotization. Not because robots will take over all the purposeful jobs, but because a basic income would give everybody the chance to do work that is meaningful. I believe in a future where the value of your work is not determined by the size of your paycheck, but by the amount of happiness you spread and the amount of meaning you give. I believe in a future where the point of education is not to prepare you for another useless job, but for a life well lived. I believe in a future where jobs are for robots and life is for people. And if basic income sounds utopian to you, then I'd like to remind you that every milestone of civilization, from the end of slavery to democracy to equal rights for men and women, was once a utopian fantasy too. Or, as Oscar Wilde wrote long ago, progress is the realization of utopias. So as I alluded to, over the last several years, I've really developed a theory that half the work done in the world would be better off left undone. That is, better off if we didn't do it in the first place. And sure enough, this has been bolstered by more recent research. People working in Western civilizations, 37% reporting their job as meaningless. And this actually moves up to about half if you include answering the question. There's like a 50-50 chance that your job is meaningless. And remember, these are not the junk jobs that we usually complain about the most, with low wages, hard, monotonous work. These junk jobs are mostly in addition to this huge proportion of meaningless jobs. Many people spend half or more of their waking hours engaged, or perhaps more appropriately, disengaged with meaningless or junk jobs. I, for one, think we can do better. This is something we need to figure out, or we're going to waft off into a world of work that's meaningless. Well, we'll close this Just for the Health of It greatest hit show with a very different perspective. Okay, well, here at Just for the Health of It, we're all about fresh perspectives, and I'd like to offer one here today with this question. Is public health in America so bad among young, supposedly healthier people that the U.S. may eventually not be able to defend itself militarily? This from the American Heart Association. U.S. soldiers have worse heart health than civilians. A smaller proportion of active Army personnel are in ideal cardiovascular health compared to civilians. Less than one-third of soldiers studied had ideal blood pressure compared to about half of the civilian population. We had expected that the percentage of ideal weight in the Army group would have been much higher because of the fitness standards to get into the Army and the physical aspects of the job. It is notable that we didn't see the advantage we expected in the Army group, and it's clear that both groups have a lot of room for improvement. Cardiovascular diseases such as heart attacks, strokes, and heart failure are the leading cause of death in the U.S. among men, both men and women, each year. That is also true of Army personnel. Cardiovascular disease affects the Army more than any other chronic disease, according to the authors, and it is on the rise. In 2014, 9.4% of Army personnel had cardiovascular diseases, compared to 6.8% in 2007, which is a trend that could impact readiness and cost U.S. taxpayers more in medical care for soldiers. It was surprising to find that Army personnel were less likely to have ideal cardiovascular health, especially due to higher blood pressure, compared to civilians of similar ages. Because recruits are screened to exclude high blood pressure and maintaining physical fitness is a major focus for the Army, we expect a lower, not higher, blood pressure in the Army. And from the Business Insider, from an article in 2015, the biggest single reason for failing to meet requirements is obesity, Major General Alan Batchelet, commander of the U.S. Army Recruiting Command, says obesity is becoming a national security issue. The obesity issue is the most troubling because the trend is going in the wrong direction. We think by 2020 it could be as high as 50%, which means only 2 in 10 would qualify to join the Army. Wow. Could obesity be the Achilles heel of the U.S. globalizing militarism? Who'd have thunk that the obesity epidemic may inadvertently be a force for peace, an ally in crippling militarism? Well, I prefer old-fashioned war resistance, but I'll take what I can get. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.